Okay, so hi everyone. We'll get going. So my name is Claude Rémillard. I'm the GPM for Release Management. And this is Donovan.
Hi, my name is Donovan Brown. And I'm very, very excited to be here. So I hope you guys are half as excited to be here as I am to show you what we have to show you today.
So basically what we'll do today is we'll talk about Release Management and more specifically, we'll go over a lot of practical experiences on really how to leverage Release Management. And Donovan will go over really a lot of specific fields that things that he's seen in the field leveraging RM. So who from the room saw the presentation we did on the previous presentation we did on Release Management? Okay, so about a third or so. All right, so the first 10 minutes is the same. So I'll ask you like three things about it. So you can go do your email or whatnot. Don't go away. The rest is not the same. It's just the intro that's the same. And don't tell the punch to the ones that haven't seen it. Like they might still think it's the butler. Okay, so I wanted to start with actually a nice story. So I know I told the same story last time. So actually, it's a story about Knight Capital. Knight Capital is a financial service firm on the New York Stock Exchange. And basically, part of their business, they have a platform that they use for trading. They had a new order handling feature, which basically what did is you want to move a certain number of shares or stocks or whatnot. And then it actually becomes a lot of micro transactions that goes at the right time with very complex algorithms to maximize the dollars on these transactions. So basically, they needed to go and go live by replacing an older version with new code. However, 9 years ago, in a previous version of that, they still had nine-year-old code that was still on the system that had never been cleaned up. Part of the new version they had was repurposing a flag from that very old version that was still in their system. And then basically, they had technical manual deployments with basically a guy following some instructions and not actually very well documented, doing everything manually and whatnot. And that copied everything very well on seven of the eight servers that they had for their production. And then they went live. They started losing $172,000 a minute. So basically, that eighth server actually was running the nine-year-old code and was doing very bad things to them and basically started creating all kinds of very, very bad transactions for them. And then they started to try and fix it. They didn't have no rollback procedures, they didn't have backup environment, they didn't have like previous points. All the steps they want were manual, not documented. So they worked on it, and at some point in their fixing process, they kind of rolled back the code on the other seven server and actually now get the eighth server doing the bad transaction. And by the time they shut it down, they had lost that almost $500 million and actually put the overall firm under bankruptcy protection. So, the impact of a really bad deployment is different for everybody. Their case is an extreme case, and of course, but for you, for us, what it means is interruption of service, bad service to your customers, maybe loss of being able to do some transaction on a commercial site, maybe actually losing real money directly or losing customer satisfaction. But basically, we have different ways, and it's a bit like, there's different ways where dysfunctional families are dysfunctional, and there's like just functional families are usually a certain type. It's kind of the same thing here. There's different ways and different problems coming to different things. So that's why we get into the idea of release management is the ability to release safely and then release and be able to do it often and with a lower cost. Why we know so much about it, and again, is when they went out and under bankruptcy protection. I mean, you just have to imagine the scene, right? Where the main guys are there and says, "Yes, Mr. Securities and Exchange Commission, we lost $500 million to a faulty flag we put in production." And obviously, there was an investigation in those times, a few years back, on Wall Street, $500 million going like this. So we actually have a SEC report with 28-page description of probably one of the worst, you know, more complete worst bug reports in history. So that's why we know so much about it. You can actually go and find it, Knight Capital, SEC, and you'll get the, you can read the whole story. So what we'll do now is I'll just talk about how we think about release management and kind of, you know, and actually try to make sure that these type of thing doesn't happen into your organization and ours. So historically, we've been developing a lot of tools from a visuals perspective on the left side of that screen, on the green side, which is how we develop and so on and so forth.
One.
All right, one. So for those who were there, I have this bad habit that was pointed to me on Monday that I say so on and so forth too often. So now I'm very conscious about it. I try not to say it, so that's why it goes one. All right. And then we want to go on to the left side where we operated. And we know with Agile, we now develop faster, we have faster cadence. And on the operation side, we don't have that same cadence. And if we think about it, we're incented and our drive in dev is to produce the most change we can, fix bugs and create new features. That's what dev is about. And then on operation, we're incented of having the least interruption possible and keep things the most stable possible, which actually is least change is better. And we kind of somewhat meet in the middle in that DevOps view. And the idea is that then you end up with a cadence that comes in and you have a bit of a bottleneck in going from dev to production, where usually deployment can be very complex. The example I just talked about is one of those cases. It can be error prone. I'm sure a lot of people have experiences where, you know, the deployment is done over the weekend. You do things, you check, you redo, you diagnose. And it can be very chaotic on when are we ready, get all the pieces, specifically for multi-team, multi-geography. The moment we have a multi-something involved, it gets chaotic. So the way we look at it is we want to automate that flow. We want that piece to be done with new human interaction, fully automated. And that's the only way we can go and actually deliver more often. So when we get new value, getting it faster in the hands of the users so that you derive that business value and minimize the risk while doing it. So kind of meet the goals on both sides. So to do that, RM does pretty much four major things. So the first one is really to automate the deployment on every one of the stages we go through. So in there, we have this concept of a release path or release pipeline, however you want to talk about it. But basically, it's a series of environments that we go through that has more and more tests. So I have a certain number of tests in dev, and if it passes, I'll go to integration. And, you know, we can have seven of those, three of those, but normally you go through a series of environments. So the first thing we do is when I want to get to an environment, it's basically one person pushes one button and we deploy. And the deployment is done and there's no human interaction. The other thing that we do is we automate the workflow. And Donovan will show a bit of that, but where we can say, well, before we deploy, we want somebody who can actually approve before the deployment, even approve and say, yeah, deploy, but only tonight or at midnight. And then we want somebody to be able to come in at the end of a stage and say, I've run all the tests and integrated. Now we can go and deploy to QA. So they approve, and that triggers the next one. So we can set all of these. And when we deploy or all these approvals, we can set emails or not. So all of these are optional, but so that the workflow itself is kind of done very easily. We don't need to hunt people down or whatnot. It's just all number two, whatnot. All right. The third thing is to deploy the same way to all the stages. So our core mechanism is that we define the deployment once, and then we change the values that we use on each of the environment. And the logic is, typically, if you look at the life of a version, I'll create a new version, I'll deploy it into the first environment, I'll find a bug, I'll go and I'll create another build, and then I'll go against the same environment. Maybe it meets these tests, I'll go to the second one, find a bug, come back, and then do another one. And by the time I actually go to production, I might have deployed it 10 times, 20 times, 200 times, depending on the cycle. So the logic is to say, well, My riskiest deployment is the one in prod. If I do it all the time, if I use the same core mechanism all the time, and I test them as a first-level citizen, the same as my database schema or my C-sharp code or any other aspect, then there's good chance that it's going to work at the other end because I've tested it the same way I test everything else. So it's that idea of use the same mechanism throughout. So the core there is we build once and deploy many times, as opposed to rebuild in between. It's you build once, we move it. And inside of the software, we give you options to just say, well, I want this is my variation in configuration from one environment to the other. And that we'll show you in a lot of details today. Yes, we'll show that in a lot of details, and actually Donovan will. But yes, that's kind of the mechanic. We'll do transformation throughout. And the last thing we do is kind of the idea of a full traceability. So when we create a new version, we create a release transaction. And what we track along our pipelines are specific releases. So when we trigger a deployment, and we can trigger a deployment or a release either manually, I create a release, I pick which builds I want to push through, or I can add to my build definition, say, well, when you're done, start a release. And then the build runs, the last thing it does, it starts a release on the IAM side, and then we'll go deploy to the first environment, run those tests. Sorry about that. Run the test associated, and then send the emails for approval or not to say, oh, now it's ready for testing the first environment or the second. And then every deployment we do, every approval, every variables we've added that we've done in the transformation is kept on that transaction so that we can go back and have a full traceability. So we can look and say currently which is the last release that went to production. This is the last build. These were the check-ins on that build. These were the work items on that build. And we have really an end-to-end traceability of the whole flow. And that becomes very important for failing elegantly. That's one of the themes we're very conscious about, is that sometimes it fails. When it fails, you want to be able to get all the logs, all the setups, settings you add, so you can go and diagnostic and make decision on roll forward, roll backward, and so on and so forth. Ah, I said it again. Sorry about that. So when we look at what we do on a stage and what we think about it when you want to start automating, is we look at what happens. So on any given stage, in IAM, we can trigger things, and we can run a number of things already in the box, and we can extend it, and we'll show you how to do that. But the first thing is you either create your environment or configure your environment that you have on Azure or on-prem. Then you'll install your bits. You'll configure your bits. Following that, you'll create some test data. Normally, that is done by running some tests or running an executable or a harness you created yourself you're adding as a tool to the system. You'll run your manual tests, and then we'll basically do notification and approval. So, sorry. So when we look at IAM, really the view we have is to look at the whole flow, but also everything we need to do on that, basically that stage stack of everything we need to do. So we'll spend quite a bit of the rest of the session to go in details and look at that. Last thing I wanted to explain before we get into the demo itself is kind of how it works. What are the components of IAM? It's a common question we get. Sorry about that. So basically, we have two clients. We have a web client to do approvals, and we have a Windows client where we do all the, actually, we can do approvals there, but we do all the configuration, the tracking, and how we deploy everything to each stage on our pipeline. Then we can start from TFS. TFS will run build, drop the file somewhere. It can be from another build system, by the way. So typically, we have a lot of customers starting with team build. But if you build coming from a third party, coming from a subcontractor, we can start with a drop location also to trigger our deployment. Then we have the server, which is a SQL database, which contains all our configuration, our history, all our transactions. And when we do a deployment, let's say I come in as an approver, to the web client, then I get to the release server, the release goes in the configuration. So approving to go to that queue environment for my app is I have these five components I need to do. And I need to actually get those components, you know, let's say the SQL component on the SQL server and a couple of services and maybe a couple of other components, let's say a website and another service on a third server. So we have this component, a little blue box. We have those on each of those target servers that will actually pull the bits from the server, so find where they were dropped, pull them, bring them to the target server, bring any additional piece of code we need to run as part of the install, and then we'll install locally on that machine. Once we're done, once each of them is finished, then it sends a success back to the server, and if all the servers are installed properly, then the stage is considered successful and we go forward. And we send the email and the rest of our workflow. If one of them fails, then we can actually set this is how I install my component, and this is what I do if I have an issue. So we have a rollback mechanism in there. So we'll execute the rollback on all of them. So we go with the principle of either all the components install or none of them install. Then we'll roll back everything we've installed so far. Usually there's dependencies on all of them. So that's kind of the core mechanics we have. At the end, I'll come back and I'll explain a new mechanics that we've announced on Monday. So I'll just come back and explain that, which is using desired state configuration as an option to perform the deployments. So what I'll do now is I'll turn it over to Donovan, and he's going to go over a number of scenarios, like really how to use it in practice.
Let's see if this switches over. Perfect. Okay, my name is Donovan Brown. Some of you recognize me, and you recognize me while we were in the booth together, and also at Ask the Expert. Before I came to Microsoft, I was a process consultant. That's a fancy way of saying I flew all around the world helping people install Team Foundation Server. That's all I did for 7 years, right? So I lived and breathed Team Foundation Server. A lot of our customers were very progressive. And before we had release management, they still wanted the software that we built with Team Build to end up on a server as soon as possible with as little human intervention as possible. Because if we could do that, we could start testing it sooner. So a lot of you have probably already arm wrestled MS Build into doing an xcopy deploy. And if not, you can go to donbrown.com where I blog and see how I did it years ago, because I also had to do that. Then we upgraded to workflow, and we figured out a way to have custom activities do xcopy deploys for us to get our bits onto a server. But there were limitations there. It would only take it to one server. We talked about the web configs. I'm going to talk in detail about the web.configs and the different ways of handling those challenges when you're inside of this application. So I think the reason that I'm so excited to come and talk to you about release management is because I know the gap that it fills. It's a gap that I saw year after year, client after client, and I almost wish I was a consultant again because I could finally run in there and say, I finally have the answer to how we're going to deploy your software and promote it from one environment to the next. I want to qualify that everything that I'm about to show you today, you can do today. You can go back to your offices right now and start utilizing everything that I'm going to show you. Release management is highly extensible, and I'm going to show you how to extend it today. I'll mention donovanbrown.com one more time because all of the custom tools that I'm going to show you today, you can go and download from my blog, right? So you can start using this stuff today as well. So let me set the stage. We are a Scrum team. Granted, this would be a very, very large Scrum team, but we're a Scrum team nonetheless, and we are writing a mission-critical application that allows us to track people. These might be enemies of the state. They might be people that are just very important that we need to track. But nonetheless, we need to track these individuals. So we write a very simple MVC application, and we're going to go through our first sprint review with our product owner. He's going to be able to click through the application and see that we can actually show him a list of people that we can track throughout our application. We're then going to be able to go back in and add people to this database. Now, I debated long and hard, do I stop here and have the audience yell out names for me to type in? Then it dawned on me, I'm a horrible, horrible speller. And no matter what you yelled out, chances are I would spell it wrong, and they're recording this, and I would be embarrassed forever. So we're just going to go with Bob Smith. Perfect. And I did it right the first time, no less. So the application works, and the product owner is generally happy with what we've delivered. But just like any good product owner, as soon as he saw it, he wanted to change it. Right? We've all been there. Every sprint review we go through, we come up with a laundry list of things that he wants to change. One of which is he says, I'd like to track the middle name. Right? We need to make sure we know the middle name as well so that we can distinguish one Donovan Brown from the other. I also happen to have a list of names already that we've been tracking before you guys wrote this system. I want that Excel spreadsheet automatically imported into this system for me. And going forward, we're going to continue to get Excel spreadsheets with people's names in it that I need to continue to add to this system. So we have to find a way to solve that for them. Okay? So we're going to have to update the website to have the middle name. We're going to have to be able to import information. We're going to have to update the database that backs this, right? Because we're obviously going to have to add a column for the middle name. He also says, I would like the way to be able to do this disconnected. Maybe a FAT client or a Windows application that I can run locally and then synchronize later. And then finally, he says, I want all this in the cloud because it's trendy and it's good and everyone else is doing it, so we have to do it too. So this has to run in Azure. So as a Scrum Master, I'm a little nervous now because he tells me it's all priority one and it all has to be done by the next sprint, right? We've all been there if you're on a Scrum team. Everything is the most important thing in the world. And it would be okay, and we'd have a fighting chance if all we had to do was write all that software. But we don't. To show it to anyone, we have to write it, and we have to deploy it. In scenarios like this in the past, when I ran Scrum teams, I would actually have tasks in my backlog that had hours against them for deploying this. Those are hours that we're going to have to spend sprint after sprint manually deploying these bits. Hours I'd much rather my team be using to develop features, not deploying those features. So what we would do is we'd arm wrestle MS Build into doing a X copy for us. But it would only go so far, and eventually a human being would still have to get involved, make modifications, and things would break. And then there goes our productivity, there goes our velocity, and now all of a sudden we become a development team who's doing more deployments than we are doing development. And that's what this tool is going to solve for us. Releasing our software becomes an afterthought. It becomes simple. It becomes something that we don't even concern ourselves with. And it happens very religiously, it happens very consistently. I'm in a little bit of an adrenaline junkie, and I decided today, this is my first demo at TechEd, I'm gonna go big or go home. So, to make this demo even harder for myself, we're also gonna run automated tests after it's been deployed to our QA server. To make it even harder for myself, if I click on this link right here, which is our QA server, it will be dead. Why? QA server is not even running right now. So part of my deployment is to actually wake up our QA server as part of our release, and then deploy all of our software out to that QA server, run our coded UI test against it to verify that our deployment went the way we wanted it to, and then when and only when I say it's okay, tell our release management system to shut that server down, right? And now that's huge if you've done anything with Azure right now. Forget to turn off one of your Azure VMs if you want to. Watch all of your credits just go right to the floor. It's really important to be able to turn those things off so that we don't pay for compute hours we're not using. Now today, playing the role of Azure will be Hyper-V. Not because Azure doesn't work, everything I said I'm going to talk about today you can do today, but not when you're inside of this hotel room and my Azure VM can't see this machine. But I want you to understand that I can use proxy servers to start other machines for me. So what I've done is I've hosted a Hyper-V system on my computer. The Hyper-V computer is currently off, and I'm going to turn that guy on and deploy to him just as if it were in Azure. Okay, so everything that I'm talking about is going to work. So here is me being a magician showing you there's no rabbit in the hat. In about 20 minutes, I'm going to come back, and hopefully I'm going to click that button, and you guys better let me hear it, because if this works, there's going to be a website there that's actually going to have people already in it, and I'm going to be able to go back in and manipulate those people. You guys ready? I got to hear you. You guys ready? Yeah. All right, let's go have some fun. All right, so let's look at the application that we're actually trying to deploy here. It's plain vanilla MVC application, and it's backed by a very cool project called a database project. I'm supposed to be talking about release management, but I kind of have a soft spot for this database project because no one knows about them. But it allows me to actually take my entire schema of my database, and every object in it, I now get to actually put in source control. It also watches those changes that I make to my database and produces something called a DACPAC file. I can then give that DACPAC file to release management, and it can make any database I want look exactly like that DACPAC file. And it won't lose any of my data. So we're tracking the fact that we added a middle name to our database with that database project. Alongside of it, we obviously have our standard data access layer library. We have an MVC application here, so it's just a normal web application. He said he wanted to be able to do this offline and synchronize later. So I have a WPF application here as well. And just for so that we don't support the setup projects anymore. I hear that they're coming back, so hooray for that. But they didn't while I did this. So what I did is I created a Wix setup project. Right? So I used Wix. It created me an MSI. That MSI will be in my output. and RM will pick up that MSI and install it for me. And I'll show you exactly how we configure that as well. I have a coded UI test. This is the coded UI test that's going to run for me after I deploy all of my bits, and obviously my unit test that I'm going to run during my build. Now, like any good cooking show, I've already done most of the cooking for us. I have all the code changes necessary. All I have to do now is check them in. When I check them in, because I have a continuous integration build created, it's going to kick off a build. That build's going to go do what a build is supposed to do, no more, no less. We're not going to ask it to deploy the code. We're simply going to ask it to tell release management to deploy the code. And release management will pick up the ball for us, and it'll run at that last mile that TFS has been missing. So I'm going to go ahead and check that in. And while that's being checked in and our build is running, I'm going to go finally talk about the one thing I think a lot of people want to hear about, this pesky little file called a web.config, right? We all, if you've done any ASP.NET development, you know how painful it can be to maintain this guy, right? Many of my organizations that I go and visit would have a folder called configs in their source control. And a subfolder of configs was dev, QA, and prod. And inside those folders, I would find completely baked web.configs with all the settings for each one of those target environments. Okay, that's the solution. Problem is, it's a maintenance nightmare. If I change any of those files, I have to change all of those files. If I change the web.config I'm using for development, I better go add that same flag to the dev, the QA, and the prod versions of that web.config. If I don't, we're definitely going to have issues. Even if I keep the files in sync, there's also a problem me actually getting the right file onto the right server. Because the build system doesn't get latest, gets everything. Now, how do I then cherry pick the right file for the right environment? It's basically a challenge that you're going to have to overcome. So what do? We mature, and we decide, what are these files doing that hang off of my web.config? That's how I found them. I'm like, I don't know what those things are. Opened them up. There's actually a lot of good help in there. What these allow you to do is only maintain the differences, right? What is different between my normal web.config and the config for debug, or the config for release, or the config for QA? And that's great, and it is a step in the right direction. The problem with these is that they are a compile time decision, not a deploy time decision. I want to take the same bits that I just built, and I want to promote them several times through several different environments. So I don't know what the values are going to be when I compile it. Matter of fact, I know for a fact whatever one of these that I choose to compile to will be wrong on every other environment but the one that I compiled it for. So if I build release, my web.config will be perfect for production. But before I can get to production, I must go through dev and QA, and in those two environments, those files are completely wrong. So a human would still have to be involved, and it's a mistake. I don't need to make the decision of my web.config when I compile it. I need to make those modifications when I deploy it, and that's exactly what release management does for us. So instead of having five copies or maintaining these transform files, what I do instead is I create an exact duplicate of it, and I give it the extension of config.token. You'll notice that here in my web.config, what I've done is I've given myself the ability to define a token. A token is any word that starts and ends with double underscores. I can then communicate that information to release management, and at the appropriate times, it will go back in and replace those tokens with whatever values I give it for each individual stage. And when we configure our components, I'll show you exactly how to do that. Okay, so does that answer everyone's questions about the config files and how those things are managed? I thought it would. Good. Because this is a very big pain point, and I was very happy to see how this stuff actually worked together. So we have an application, and hopefully our build completed, and we are at least on the right track of this demo. If I were to go back and look at it, perfectly. And let's go back and look at one other item here. One thing that you'll notice that's a little different about this is this section. This is where build said, okay, I'm a special type of build. Donovan wants me to actually be deployed and promoted through these different environments. So what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to tell release management, hey, release management, I have a build for you, and you need to start it through the workflow of getting it from each individual stage and do whatever it is Donovan needs you to do to make your way into production. So we don't ask build to do anything more than just notify release management that there's something for him to do. So now let's go look at the star of the show today, which is release management. What I'm going to do is I'm actually going to start from right to left on these tabs and literally build our way up to something called a release template, which is where all the magic actually starts to happen. Now, I shouldn't have shown you this one. I'm going to actually jump off of here real quick. I'm going to ask you guys a question. We've identified five things that we want to do during our deployment. We're going to create an SSIS package. The reason why we're going to do that is it's going to allow us to use the Excel file we have today and continue to use Excel files that we get in the future, and it will transform that data and put it in SQL Server for us. So I have an SSIS solution that I have as part of my build. You didn't see it here because it's done inside SQL Data Tools, but it is in source control, it's part of my build, and it will be in my output. I have a database project that I described that's going to track all the changes to my database. I have my MVC application. I have my WPF application that I'm going to put in with an MSI, and I want to run test. Those are five actions that we want to take. Release management out of the box does four of those. Yell out which one it doesn't do. I'm just curious what you know. Which one does it not do out of the box? Exactly. SSIS. Out of the box, release management does not handle SSIS. But don't let that stop you. Whenever, I know right now, I can predict the question we're going to get 90% of the time after this session. I'm going to answer it for you right now. The question is, well, can you guys also do X? Right? Can you deploy X? X being any application, any technology that you have today in your framework. And whenever I get asked that question, I answer it kind of like a politician. Right? You want to ask me that question? I'm going to answer it by asking you a question. Can the technology or the application that you're interested in deploying be deployed by a PowerShell script, by an executable that already exists, or by a command line? If the answer is yes, then the answer is yes. Anything I can do from PowerShell, anything I can do from a command line, or any executable that already exists that I can execute using release management. I'll show you how to do that. So this is the takeaway, is that the sky is the limit. If you look here at the tools that come out of the box, the ones at the top that don't have a publisher, I wrote all of those. And I wrote them very, very quickly because I'm going to show you the anatomy. It's not very difficult. I did some research on SSIS because that is the number one requested technology whenever I do these demos. I used to be a process consultant. Now I'm a TSP. Basically, all I have to do are demos like this for customers. It's a pretty cool job, to tell you the truth. So if you can get one of them, I jump right on top of that job. It's a very cool job. But every time I show release management, the first question I ask is, we do SSIS here. Can you deploy that as well? So I wanted to make sure that I showed them exactly how to deploy that in this demo. Now, there's two different options that you can do for that. DTUtil, if you're familiar with it, will allow you to copy packages around. And what I realized is that because I'm using the latest version of the SQL Server data tools, it creates a solution package, and the output of it is called an ISPAC file. Very similar to a DACPAC file for database, an ISPAC file is everything that I need to be able to deploy this particular SSIS package. So what I did is I did some research, and I realized that there's actually an executable that already exists. So if we come in here, this executable, IaaS deployment wizard.exe, is already built by Microsoft and the SQL Server team so that I can deploy these packages. I don't have to do anything but simply tell release management, this is the file that I want you to execute when I give you an ISPAC file for you to deploy. Now, it obviously has to know a couple things about it, and I can actually tell it that, right? Remember the underscore underscore? You'll see there, I need to tell it the file name, I need to tell it the destination server, and I need to tell it the path. The reason that they're tokenized here is because when I define my release template, the release template diagram, the little designer there, will give me a text box for me to enter in those individual information for each individual stage that I intend to deploy on. That's how I'll be able to control what's different between one environment and the next. Okay? I did this also, like I said, today we're going to be using Hyper-V instead of Azure. And what I had to do there is write myself a little PowerShell script that allows me to control Hyper-V. Hyper-V can be controlled by PowerShell as well. I wrote a very simple script that knows how to start and how to stop a Hyper-V server. I also need to tell it what server that Hyper-V is being hosted on, and obviously the name of the Hyper-V machine that I want it to fire up. It was that simple. And now I can mimic the exact same functionality we have in Azure here on site with a Hyper-V system instead. So once I build out my tools, I can then go ahead and basically package them up into what we call actions. Now, actions allow me to easily use tools that I have in my toolbox. For example, look at all these here that are for IIS. They all use the exact same executable, but I don't want the users of that tool to have to know all the different parameters to create an app pool or to recycle an app pool. I can fill out 90% of those parameters for them if I know that the action that you're trying to create or the action that you're trying to perform is creating an app pool. All you really need to tell me then is the fact that this is the name, this is the identity that I want you to use, whatever the case might be. So I can take these tools and create these actions that make using those tools that much easier. So again, highly extensible. So I've done that, and I've created all of the custom tools and actions that we need to be able to perform what it is that we're trying to perform. Once I have my tools and I have my actions, I can now work on my servers. Do not be alarmed that this server is off. The reason that this server is offline is because it literally is turned off. That is the VM that we are going to have to fire up as part of our deployment to get the bits deployed to it. This is exactly how your Azure VMs will appear in your list as well, because you should not have them running unless you're using them. They'll be off. And what we're going to use is we're going to use the bottom guy. The bottom deployer is actually installed on my laptop. It's always running, it's always there, and he never deploys anything. He's actually just there to wake up and do other tasks for me. And we call those proxy deployers, because they actually don't deploy anything. So if your proxy, if your deployer doesn't do anything, but doesn't just say doesn't install anything, but perform some other action, we just flag that as a proxy deployer for us. Okay? And then finally, we have the deployer at the top. This guy is this actual VM that I'm running. This is our dev environment. So when I deploy to my dev environment, I'm deploying to that machine. And I'm going to show you how we build our environments here in just a second. After I have my machines with their deployers on it, and Claude told you what the deployer does, it's the actual workhorse that sits on each individual machine, I can then combine those into what we call environments. And I'm going to actually look at the QA environment because that's the most interesting one. This one actually has two different machines in it. The actual machine that's currently off and the proxy beneath it that's going to be used to turn it on. And you'll notice over here on the right-hand side, I have something called a tag. These tags are very, very powerful concept. Let's say, for example, I were to have a farm of application servers. Let's say there's 10 of them. I would have to repeat the sequence to deploy 10 times, dragging and dropping everything 10 times. And let's say that sequence changes. That's going to become a maintenance nightmare. Let's say, for example, we have 10 servers and we want to add an 11th. Now I have to go throughout the entire system and explain to them there's now 11 servers, not just 10 servers. But by actually creating a tag instead, I then perform the actions that I need on the tag. And then as long as the environments are tagged correctly, I never have to worry about the actual physical servers that are being used. I can swap them as I need to, I can scale up or scale down, and my release template is going to work perfectly regardless. So tags are a really nice addition to release management. And you'll see that I'll be using them when we get to our release template. The next step above our environments is what we call a release path. And a release path defines exactly what stages we intend to go through. We have a dev environment, we have a QA environment, and we have a production environment. And we get to tag those with the environment that they go to, and this is where all the approvals come to life. Even if you can strong arm MS Build into copying files to a server for you, who said it was all right? Who pushed the button who said it's okay to deploy to that environment? Is there any way for me to say, no, no, MS Build, don't do that? No, once I push the button to build, it's copying those files out there because it doesn't know any better. With this approval process, I have several different areas where I can intervene and determine, do I want this to continue or do I need it to stop? And on the acceptance step, which I'll show you here when we go to QA, I can actually defer that. I can accept it today, but want the deployment done in the future, which is really important if I'm a QA team with a very long QA cycle. I might be smack dab in the middle of testing your previous release, and now you have a new build waiting for me. Well, if I were to take that build right now, it would invalidate all of my current test results, and I'd have to start over again. But what I can do is I can go ahead and say, you know what, we're going to be done by Friday. Okay, release management, I accept this today, but I don't want you to deploy it until Friday. And it'll go to sleep, and on Friday, it'll wake up once we're done with our testing, and then finally deploy the bits to our environment, so that when I come in Monday morning, we're ready to start testing the next release. So I don't have to remember to come back and approve it. I can approve it now, but defer the installation until later. I can actually have the approver be an individual or a group. If it's a group, anyone in that group will have the authority to push it past that particular acceptance. So you don't have to worry about your lead developer going on vacation. Anyone in your dev team will have the permissions to promote or to accept that particular approval. If I need additional approvals, I can add as many as I'd like here along the bottom, and everyone on there will have to approve them before it actually moves on to the next stage. Okay? You're going to see this in action here in just a moment. After we have our release path defined, we can finally go back in and talk about our components. We'd identified our components when I was counting on my fingers and said there's five of them, the database, the SSIS package. And I actually do something a little different with my SSIS. I not only deploy it, I also execute it, right? So I actually had two tools that I created for SSIS. Because just installing it's not good enough. I need the data to show up instantly. So I actually created a tool that knows how to go back and execute an SSIS package for me as well. So each one of these components has to be defined by where do I pick up the files and what tool do I use once I know where the files are located. So let me show you the anatomy of one of those. We'll pick the website because this is a good one. So you can use this with or without TFS. If you want to integrate it with TFS, you need to be using TFS 2010, 12, or 13. And what we're doing here is we're saying this release is tied to a specific build definition. And knowing that information, it actually can go and query what the drop location is. And then what I'm telling him is that below that drop location in a folder named this, you will find all the files necessary for my website. So I want you to then pick up all those files, and I want you to use a particular tool to deploy them. The tool that we've chosen to use is the Xcopy Deployer. It is simple, that literally it's that simple. That's one of the beautiful things about ASP.NET. You can Xcopy deploy these things. Just copy them onto your server, and the site will just fire right up. And that's exactly what we're asking the tool to do. Now, one thing that's very important here is how do we handle that database token that we were talking about in our web.config? How will we be able to change it from one environment to the next? And that's on this very next tab here called Configuration Variables. You remember, I called it underscore, underscore, database, underscore, underscore. So I tell the tool that there's going to be a token that you're going to find called database. And here I'm going to say, after you actually deploy my website, I want you to find all the web.configs that you can, and then go back in and find every token for database and set it to whatever it is I told you to set it to for this particular stage. So all of our web.config is actually handled inside of release management now. And it's rinse and repeat for the other items. So for example, the SSIS package, I tell it where to pick it up, which is in the root folder. I tell it to use my custom deployer to deploy my SSIS packages, and then what parameters I want to be able to provide when I actually configure that component. Final piece, and then I'm actually going to see if this stuff works or not. This is what we call our release template. Our release template is a Windows workflow designer that allows me to go back in and define exactly what actions I want to take on each of the machines. I want to deploy my website, my database, and my WPF on my dev server. My dev server is a little unique. We've already deployed there. I've already gone into IIS manually, and I've created the website. I don't need you to create it again, right? I've already created the folder structure. And because we're getting real data from those Excel files, we don't want to import that into our database locally or in our dev environment, right? Because that information is protected. We have no business looking at it. So this is a very simple way to deploy our code into our development environment. And when we go to QA, however, it's going to be a drastically different story. And I'll show you that path here in just a second. If I look at one of these items here, you'll notice that I can actually set the values of the database. This is the token. So for this particular environment, I want my database connection string to point to TechEd. And maybe I want it to point to TechEd QA in a different environment. And I can actually look at all my configuration variables here at the bottom and see exactly what each of the variables will be in each environment. Right? So it's really nice for me to make sure that I've updated them appropriately. If they're supposed to be the same, they actually are the same in every one of my environments. I don't have to open up each individual workflow individually. I can go and look at all of that data at one really quick area. So now let's look at our QA stage. Our QA stage has a lot of different items in it. It's far more complicated. Let's see if I can zoom in a little bit on this. The very first part that's tagged with proxy, that is the tag that I defined for a machine that's going to play the role of a proxy. I don't know the name of the machine. I don't care the name of the machine. If I've tagged a machine as a proxy, I want release management to tell him to go wake up a Hyper-V machine for me. And that's exactly what that first step does for me. Once that machine is waking up, it then goes to the TechEd machine and starts setting up my IIS. That machine is almost completely empty. I built a 2012 R2 machine, I installed SQL Server, and I enabled the role for IIS. I did not create an application pool, I did not create a website, I did not install any databases. It's about as clean as it can get. The reason that I did that is because if you're using your Azure benefits right now, you can go and ask Azure, please fire up a VM for me that already has SQL Server on it. And it will. It'll fire up a VM, SQL Server is already there and installed, and you're ready to rock and roll. So I wanted to do as little as I had to and see how far I could get with deploying this application on a clean machine. So if you'll notice here, at the bottom, I'm actually creating an app pool, creating a website, then I'm deploying the website, and it gets really interesting down here when we start looking at our SSIS using our custom tools. And you can see all the different parameters. This over here is our toolbox with all the things that you can actually do when you're trying to build one of these workflows. there's actions that come out of the box. And that Hyper-V category there is one that I added myself so that I could put in all my custom tools that would deal with Hyper-V. So you can categorize even the ones that you built yourself. It looks like they just came out of the box and they're very easy for you to use. Okay? We also have rollback mechanisms. You might see the activity here for rollback. Claude actually alluded to this for us as well. At any point, as if something bad were to happen, the system is smart enough to be able to trigger a sequence that will actually allow you to roll back and do a recovery over the fact that something bad actually happened. Okay? So that mechanism is built into the system as well. So what I'm going to do now is we're going to go ahead and talk about a real live approval. So if we go over to our releases, we should see a release already running. So let's go to our releases tab here. This is the release that's already started because build said, hey, release, I have a build for you to go and release. So let's go ahead and double click on this guy. And we can see that there is a log of everything that it's done so far, and I can see everywhere it intends to go. We're currently sitting on this stage here, basically saying I need to validate my deployment. So I would have been sent an email saying, Donovan, I've deployed your code out. I need you to go and verify that it actually did what it's supposed to do. Otherwise, I'm just going to sit here and not do anything. So I'm then going to come back either to this user interface or to a website, and I'm going to show you both user interfaces on how I can actually approve this and move it forward. So let's go back here and look at this tab here that says My Approval Request. And it shows me exactly what stage I'm in and what it is that I'm trying to approve. And I'm going to go ahead and say I approve this. And let's say, before I say anything, let's go verify and see if it really did anything. Because if I go back to dev now, what should happen? This is my dev machine. I've already deployed. What should I see differently? Middle name, exactly, right? If I go to people now, I better have a column in here for middle name. This is verifying that to the dev environment, we were actually able to successfully deploy the changes. And as you'll see, the names that I added before are still there. So I was able to update my database schema, but not lose a single bit of data that was already in my database, right? So it's really nice for it to be able to handle that for us. Let's verify that it works. We'll see if I can actually store a middle name in here. And voila. Code works, we deployed, and as a developer, I can say, no, it looks good. I think it's okay for QA to get their hands on this code, and it's now my ability to go back in and approve that. If I thought this code didn't work or I would have gotten an error, I could have quickly just said, no, reject this. It would have killed the release, and then we could try again without inundating QA with builds that they have nothing to do with. Okay, so it's really nice for this approval process to allow me to intervene and not force it through the pipeline even when it's not ready to make it there. So let's go back since we verified it and say, yeah, looks good. Now what's going to happen is our QA manager is about to get an email saying the dev team thinks there's a build that you might be interested in, but it's not going to deploy anything on their machine. At this point, it has not touched their machines at all. It has just sent an email saying, would you like to accept this build? And if I say yes, then all of a sudden my machines are going to get updated. If I say no, then they're going to basically stop the build, and I'll give a reason on why I said no, and they'll be able to go back in and see that. So let's show you the other way that I can actually approve this. So as the QA person, I get an email, and then I'm going to come over, I'm going to click the link in my email, and it's going to take me to an address that looks very much like this one. From a licensing perspective, anyone who wants to be able to come in and approve can approve. Right, they can go to this website. It might be your stakeholder, might be your QA lead, might be your ops guy. They will have access to this user interface so they can go back in there and start looking at where it currently is. They can look at where it's been. They can look at where it's actually going to be going as well. They can actually even review what components are you about to install on my machine. Do I even want you installing these components on my machine? So it allows me to review them before I accept them. And because this is that unique acceptance task, I have the ability to not only approve it, but to actually defer it to some time in the future. This is what I was talking about before. Because if you notice, when I said everything looks good, there was no option for me to put a date on there, right? Because all the damage had been done. All the bits had already been deployed. There's nothing for me to defer at that point. But at this point, no bits have been moved. They're just sitting there ready to be moved, and I could defer it if I so chose. But I obviously, for demo, I want it to go now. So here goes nothing. Let's see if this works. So now what should happen is release management says, okay, Donovan, you've given me the go-ahead. I'm going to try to do everything that you told me to do. That means the SSIS, the database, the coded UI test, everything. And hopefully in a couple minutes, I'm going to be able to go back to that website, click on that QA link, and I better hear something from this crowd because this is the most aggressive release management demo I've ever attempted. right? Of course, I have attempted it 20 times now since I was told I was going to speak at TechEd, so it should work, but we've all done demos and we know how those can go. It could be a very, very bad situation here in a second. So once we go back, I'm going to start to show you what it looks like when it's running. So if we were to come back here and look at our releases. I want to go back to where I was. It should be in progress, and it is actually running all of those different components we talked about. That sequence that I identified in my release template, it's running all of those things for us right now. And what it's also going to run for us is the ability to run our test, right? As it's running it, it's keeping a log of everything that's actually happening. And what you'll notice here is if we go back to our servers, that server is now clearly ready, right? Because while I was talking to you, the proxy turned it on. The agent came online, communicated with the release management server and said, okay, do I have anything to do? You bet you do. Go start doing all this stuff that we need you to deploy. So that's why he's ready. I have another stage at the beginning of my production stage that will actually shut this guy down. But before doing that, I'm obviously going to go visit the website. We should see new data in that database that wasn't there before because it's brand new if my SSIS package worked the way I wanted it to. And then I'll go through and I'll modify someone's middle name and maybe delete a person to prove that the application works the way that it's supposed to. If my test ran, the app should run really, really quickly because it would have already been jitted for me, right? Because as my coded UI test wakes up, launches a web browser and hits the app, it's going to have to go and actually run the application for us. So let's go back and see if we can look at the status of this guy and see where our release is. And hopefully our test is run, and I will be very excited. So one thing that Claude talked about in one of the other demos that we were talking about is that we keep track of everything that happens by every tool and every component. So this is the troubleshooting part he talked about. Now, we track what we tell the tools to do, but if the tool itself creates its own log file, we can actually present that to you as well. And that's exactly what happened down here when we deployed our WPF application. What I like about this is that it allows me to debug from two different levels. Did release management tell the tool the right things to do? And did the tool respond the way that I expected it to respond? So if we go keep going forward here, hopefully what will happen is our tests are going to run. We're going to get a test log here. Now, these tests that are running actually communicate with the entire Team Foundation Server ecosystem, which means if I go back into Microsoft Test Manager and I find this test case, I will actually be able to see the fact that release management ran these tests for me and what the test results were for, right? So come on, we got to get a drum roll here. Hopefully these aren't going to be taking much, much longer. So have I covered everything you can think I could possibly cover on that? Have I missed anything? Let's see what happened here. Dun, dun, dun. It looks like everything ran successfully. So here is the big point here. Let's go back to a web browser. And what I'm going to have to do is click on this button. But before I do, how many of you just, let me hear the ayes who think this is going to work. Ayes? The nays, be honest. Oh, there's one. You didn't say nay, but I saw your hand go up. I appreciate you. Oh, you don't think it's going to work either? Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's mean. Okay, so let's see. The drum roll, please. And voila. This app, thank you. Thank you very much. We have taken a machine that wasn't even running, had nothing but IIS configured, and have deployed an application. And not only did we deploy an SSIS package, but we actually ran that SSIS package, and we have people's name in there. You might notice that my name is in there twice. The reason why is because I was in the list. Don't know why I'm being watched, but clearly I was being watched. And I also add my name as part of the test data. So when the test ran, it put my name in there again. That's how I know the test ran as well. So what we're going to do is we're simply going to go here and click on edit and prove that this works. Don't ask me what the L is because I only get called that when I'm in trouble, and hopefully I'm not in trouble right now. And we're going to go ahead and delete it, and as we can see, the application works exactly like we want. Now that I'm happy and QA is happy, they've spent their time on the machine and they've gone and done their manual testing, we don't want to waste the resources. We want this machine, now that we're done with it, to be shut down gracefully. And that's going to be the final trick, if I can pull this one off here. And I'm going to do something a little different here. We're going to go back to the web. Actually, do I want to do that from the web? Let me go back to RM real quick. I should have another approval request here. Basically saying, do you want us to let us leave the QA stage? because it worked perfectly. And now what's happening is the production person, whoever controls that prod environment, just got an email. And at this point, we no longer need the QA machine. If we're about to move to prod, we're clearly done in QA. And what I'm going to do is one more time, go back to our web and show you how that user interface works one more time. So we're going to go back to HTTP, TFS release management. And lo and behold, I now see I'm in the prod stage. I can see where I've, again, where I've been. Everything was accepted. Everything looked good. When I go ahead and approve this, I'm going to go ahead and show you something else here. So let's see if I can get my, I wanted to show you, but I can't get my thing to come back, my Hyper-V machine. But I can't seem to get my, my RDP to come back up. But what you would see is that my Hyper-V machine, I have the where you can see the status. It's currently running, but it will actually turn itself completely off and save all of our information for you. So that's what I wanted to show you. Everything that I just showed you, you can do today, every single bit of it. None of this is vapor. None of this is future. This is now. And all the custom tools that I created are available on donovanbrown.com. So it's done. So the fact that it's done means that it actually was able to shut down my system for me as well. So thank you so very, very much.
Thanks.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I'll just take another 5 minutes, and then we'll go for questions.
We have plenty of time.
I have plenty of time. Good. So I'll take 7 minutes, and we'll go for questions. So what I'll talk is everything we can do today, and I'll talk about what's coming a little bit. We announced on Monday an alternate way to do deployment. So we added additional tools in the box, and the main one is to use what we call DSC, desired state configuration, from the PowerShell team, as a way to do deployment. Who understand what DSC is? Who went to one of the DSC? Okay, so about a quarter or a third. Okay, so basically what DSC is, it's really when we do deployment, as we've seen, we start with a certain assumption of what our target is, so what the target environment is. And then in our deployment procedure, we actually define all the actions that we need to do so that we reach our desired end state. When we go with DSC, we kind of work in a different way. It's a completely different premise of thinking. Is instead of doing all these actions, what we do is we actually define what we want that end state to be. So we more or less like create a manifest of, this is what I want my environment to be. So what I pass as parameters is not actions to do. It's more the result of the actions that I expect to see. And then what happens is, on the target server, there's a DSC capabilities included in Windows that actually looks at that manifest. And for every descriptions I have in there, basically we'll do three things. It will do get the current status of the machine. It's going to test against my desired configuration. So I need this version of my component. I already have it. I won't do anything. I want this version of IS. I don't have it. Then I'm going to set it to be to that configuration. So the how we get to the state we want, we actually let DSC do that. And what we do instead is we describe in a script, this is what we want as a target result. Obviously, there's a bit of magic there. The set happens, and you know how does DSC know how to set my components and these different technologies? So the way to do that is so that it can kind of make it so for us. Is what we call DSC resources. So those DSC resources is actually, we write them in PowerShell, and we can create that set of resources. We write it once for our organization or for the community, and the idea is that Microsoft starting to create those. We're looking at the community using shared galleries to basically say, well, we've already figured out how to install IIS. So when you create your an RM, you'll just use those existing resources, install them on your servers, and then basically the DSC capabilities knows how to do that. If you need to add to it, you basically add these. So instead of writing a PowerShell script, you actually write a DSC resource that knows how to do a certain thing that's specific to your environment. You add it to the capability to the target server, and then basically, DSC will just use it. So everybody composing deployments can go and say, well, I want this to be this way. The system knows how to do that, basically. So it's a different perspective. What we like a lot about DSC, for is that actually those definitions are already files that we can keep and we can check in as code. So and one of our goals with RM is to really go fully config as code so that we can actually check in all of these at the same time as we do our code, our config files, so everything is there. So for example, I can know currently my last deployment in prod is for check-in 55. Well, I can check out from check-in 55 and use that to go and deploy into test or into staging, or I can compare between two versions. So there's a lot of benefits in being config as code. From a also capturing, you know, even further exactly what we had the code behind, how we did things, and from an audit perspective, we're getting all those benefits. So, and as we go forward, you'll see a lot of push, and I think there's something like, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60 sessions this week on DSC. So there's a big momentum. So as Visual Studio, we'll continue and we'll add a lot of tooling around that, around the usage of DSC as one of the mechanism to do this. And it fits well in RM. It's just an alternate mechanism to do so. And that's probably where we'll continue doing a lot of investment. One of the big difference, if you remember kind of the structure, the way we work with deployer, another advantage of DSC, it is a Windows component. It's part of Windows. So when we look at our story, it's more or less the deployers are already on inside of Windows. So you don't need to actually go and install deployers on every machine, or when you create a new machine, make sure you put a deployer on it, configure it to talk to the server. All of that goes away. So we end up with an agentless deployment mechanism, which is easier to maintain our network of deployers and basically the capability for RM. So from an RM perspective, it's kind of interesting. So what I'll do is I'll just take a few minutes. On Tuesday, we did a kind of a more detailed demo of DSC, how we use it. So I'll just refresh it for those who haven't seen it. And then you can actually find it on web if you want to see the more detail of how we're using it. So I'll just go here. The other thing also we're adding, and that's part of our CTP for update 3 upcoming. So we're presenting kind of the what's coming down. It will be available next week as part of that CTP, so you can download and start playing with it. So one of the things we added at the same time is the ability to use directly your Azure subscription to set targets. So you set up your Azure subscription, you set up your environments, and here you're just coming and define that subscription. You use kind of the identifier you get on Azure. And what happens if you add it to the admin into your Azure subscription, then when we get onto our environment, will actually synchronize automatically with your Azure subscription and bring all these environment and all these servers. So those will automatically populate in there. Like you see here, for example, I have all these different servers that came with that. And they're actually already on Azure organized as environment. So we have those that we can use. Notice also I can have a mix. I can have some app using DSC deployment and my app I've already set up with deployers. I can use them and use the deployers to use them. So I have a mix and match of the two modes at the same time. And we'll continue to support both. So when I go to the app itself, and I'll just use this guy, the main difference is that my toolbox is a lot less, has a lot less elements as part of it. Because what we're adding is really this ability to do a deployment with DSC, and I'll just bring it, where we will define, well, if you want to do the deployment, use this PowerShell file, which describes that the DSC, what we want, so my desired state. And we have a secondary file, which actually will have like specific configuration for that environment. And the same way, we'll show them side by side. We do all these things that we do on top of the configuration, but in a context of a DSC file. The DSC files themselves will look something like this. For example, this is my description of what I want it to be. I want to make sure that I have a web server, ASP, and so on and so forth. Third time?
Fourth time, yeah.
And then I have like the specific values that I have for them. So those are end up being into those files that I'm using in my in my action to just use them and go and do the deployment. So I just wanted to at least introduce the idea of DSC so that you see it. We'll be at the booth, at the Visual Studio booth, if you want to know more information. Let me go back to PowerPoint.
To kind of drive that point home, you remember I said I have a server that has I had configured the SSIS role. I wouldn't have to do that anymore. I would need to be able to tell it, make sure he has SSIS on it already. I would have been able to bring up even a more virgin type of machine, right? I don't have to configure anything. I just tell it, here's a picture of what I want it to look like. And it just goes and makes it so. So I would have been done. I would have had to do a lot less to prepare that machine if I was using DSC.
Yeah. And the key is we'll be able to leverage what others do and in different community galleries. Of course, Microsoft will do some. We already have MVP starting to create a lot of those DSC modules that we can leverage for everyone. So those are different sessions that are also available on the subject. You'll also be able to go there's a lab on DSC that you can go, and there's a number of resources that are available. The sessions are on Channel 9, so if you haven't seen the other session focusing more on DSC, you can also go look at it on the Channel 9.
And one other thing I'd like to, this is the point that I wanted to drive home. This was my first time speaking at TechEd. I can't tell you how excited I was to be able to come and do this. For me to be able to come and do it again, I really need you to fill out those evals. So if you enjoyed the time we spent together and would like to have me speak to you again, and Claude as well, please fill out your evals for us in all criticism. I want to be as good as I can at this, so if there's something I could do better, please make sure you fill out your evals and let us know.
All right. Thanks, so now we'll take questions where we kept...
We have we have 8-9 minutes now, so we can still take some questions.
So we'll take the questions. Oh, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yes?
Oh, that's a good one. Come up. Yeah, that's a good question. Perfect.
So the question was, can we will we have a DSC resource to turn up Hyper-V? And the answer is yes, this one's already there.
Great
but
question.
Arun there is the DSC guy on our
team.
Yes,
exactly. I'm the deployer question answerer. He's the DSC answerer.
Yes.
Sure.
So the question is, I want to be able to deploy, but take some machines out, deploy on them, see how it goes, and then bring them back in. So what we call a canary deployment. So you do that with all those servers into one environment. We have control flows for both parallel and sequential. So you would use that combination, and you might say, for example, deploy to this one machine, not necessarily attack to the first one, and then at the end run your validation test, maybe await, and then if it's okay, then you'd go again on the same environment to the other machine, maybe tag with the two next and do those two in parallel. If it's good, then do all the rest in parallel. So that's probably the way we would handle it. Yes, to the right.
Oh, to the right, you're going to, okay.
So if you do a release using a DMS build, are you able to see what
changes are located with the release from within release manager? So the question is, if you do a release from build, are you able to see the change set related to that change from inside of RM? So the answer is no, but it's coming very, very, very soon. So I'm not making a formal announcement on any date. But it's something we're aware of, it's something we're working on, and it's very high on the top of our list. So it's coming very, very shortly. And by the way, we're thinking about not just what's different, but what's different based on where you are. In dev, what's new might be two items, but if the last time I went to prod was a month ago, the what's new compared to prod might be 50 items. So we'll give you control to say what's new compared to which targets. So that's kind of what we're working on.
We had one right here. Well, yeah.
How could this be leveraged for release deployments where you see, batch of clients gets the product and then several weeks later you can roll it out for the rest of your production?
Those could definitely be stages, right? The first stage could be the first batch of people who are going to get it. And until we approve it, will we even allow those other ones? So that stage would be the environments that are in your first phase. Then you would have another stage that is the environments that are going to get it your next stage.
And just to point out, it was not obvious in the presentation, but that's why on a stage we have the concept of stage and environment separately.
Exactly.
The stage is a business stage. So you could have three stages on the same environment based on that business decision. So that's to support actually a scenario like this one.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So with the new DSC deployment options, is licensing going to be still the same?
So with DSC, will the licensing be the same? The answer is yes. We license by target server you go to. So whether you use DSC or you use a deploy based, for us it's the same licensing. You want to go to $50, you need to cover your licensing for $50. For more detail on licensing, let's talk at the booth or talk to your Microsoft representative. any other questions? Yes?
Ooh, that's a. I should have covered that. That's a really
great question.
Yeah.
So what if you don't have access to the production environment from your release server? Actually, the logic we have is that the deployer pulls the information from the server. So prod needs to have access to RM. RM does not need to have access from prod. So the default for us is really actually we have a queue. So when you approve, we say this deployer has to do this 5 thing, that other deployer, and the deployer comes on a regular schedule and says, do you have work for me? Yes. It picks up the work, downloads what it needs, so that you don't have to have access from TFS or for RM to push to prod. That's a very common scenario. Usually, we don't have access to prod, but prod has access to the server. Other questions?
Yeah, there's one
yes.
over there in the corner. Say again? Oh, he's talking about the workflow diagram.
Okay, so the release template right now are kept in our database. They're not kept in source control. As we go forward, when I was saying earlier, we're really going configuration as code. So we'll be doing that. So right now it's XAML, it's in the database. You could put them here, but we'll make it a lot easier to point, I want to save it to source control with the rest. So that's one of our goals. We're going fully config as code for everything, basically.
The one in the back.
Was there a special build template that you used?
Ooh, good question. Very good question.
So is there a special build template that you use?
Yeah, there's actually a couple things. So if you have never customized your build template, when you install RM, you're going to get a build template that you can simply overwrite the one that you have. If you've customized yours, there's steps to actually add the bits and pieces that you need. But because I had to do the same thing here, my build definition is actually custom. Because out of the box, the SSIS solutions don't get built by TFS 2013, right? But I blogged exactly what I had to do to my build to make 2013 build the 2010 SSIS. So donovanbrown.com will have literally have exactly what I did to get this demo to work.
Uh-huh. Yes? Right. So the question is, we have ATFS 2010. Can we use it with TFS 2010? The answer is yes. Actually, RM sits separately. So from RM, we can take component from TFS 2010, 12, 13. From other source control on the draw application, we have an executable to trigger it. And actually, on the same app, we can actually... We could say, well, my app, this component comes from this TFS 2010 server, that component comes from that TFS 2013 server, and we just assemble them. So for us, every component can have its own source. It's a separate server that's besides TFS, and we can contact the others. Eventually, we'll move it into one TFS, but inside, we have one of the tabs in admin is configure links to other TFS. And then we can take from any of those.
Yes.
Yes.
I think I saw another couple more hands go up
yes.
right
here. Right. That's coming. We're working on it. I think, and I'm comfortable saying that because after the acquisition, that was on Brian Harry's first blog. So, yes, we're working on it. But for sure, if I could give you a timeline, it would have been in one of the keynotes. well, okay, so there's two things. That's a good point. So maybe I answered the wrong question. So there might be two questions. Is I am running as a VSO service. We're working on that. That will come. The other one is on-prem RM consuming builds built by VSO. That already works. So on VSO, you can drop them and then trigger from our RM on-prem. So I'm not sure which of the two questions you asked, but that's the
answer
state of the art for both.
Okay. You do not need TFS to use release management.
Right.
It can pick up from any UNC path you want it to pick up from.
So we can build it.
Right. You would have to find another way to initiate it, right? The reason you want to integrate is for the traceability and the fact that we can have a build initiate it. But if you're not using TFS, you can manually start a release if you wanted to, or from a command line that we have, you can actually queue one of them up as well.
And all your builds you did were off the same branch as TFS?
They were. For this demo, they were.
Yeah.
Sure, and you can have a path for each one of those, for sure.
All right, so I think we're pretty much out of time.
Yeah, we're dead zero. So
we'll take a couple of questions here if you want one-on-one, and then we'll go to the Visual Studio boot if you want more detailed discussion. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.